Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Breaking records is often a positive thing, but in the case of 2014 being the hottest year on record, well, that's a record that I think we'd maybe rather not have broken. We're going to find out what caused it and what it means going forward as we talk with our weather guy, Steve Ackerman, director of the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies at UW, professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. Steve, welcome.
It's great to be here on this snowy day.
Yeah, getting some snow today. John Martin is with us as well, professor in the Department of Atmospheric and Oceanic Sciences at UW-Madison. On sabbatical this year, but coming in to do his work on the air.
I love the show, and I've been busy as a beaver at home, so it's been a great year.
I like that. I like that. Well, here we are, 2014, hottest year on record ever. How is that measured, by the way? How do we know?
I think it's a global average surface temperature that they do that with and make that statement. And it's so interesting. I must say, I'm going to give you a little bit longer answer than maybe you wanted. Yeah. A year ago at this time, we were in the middle of what was a regionally very cold winter, persistently cold winter. And I've been tracking a measure of how cold the whole hemisphere is, and I've been called naive for doing that. But I was just curious. There's a difference. Naivete implies you have a reason. I was just curious. Turns out last winter, even in the midst of our regional cold, was the warmest such winter, the warmest winter by the measure I've developed since 1948. And that's as far back as that record goes.
Wow.
So I had an initial inkling that this was going to be one of those years that would get in the top list. Then I guess the summit pushed us over the edge.
And your measure is different than surface temperature.
It is. Right? It correlates very highly. Yeah. I just found that out in response to reviews for this work I'm doing. But it correlates extremely highly. 70% of the variance is explained of the surface temperature by the 850 temperature.
Oh, wow.
So it's pretty highly connected. And I didn't know that before. But so anyway, we got off to a warm start in the winter. And I guess the summer put us over.
And well, now, what does it mean?
I guess just means this is the warmest year since, what, 1871 or 1870, I think the record goes back.
It's going back that far.
That's a long time.
Yeah. And it's, you know, continuing the trend that we've been seeing for many years, and that the climate's warming. And it's due to human activities. And so there you go.
Right. And I think what you said, Steve, is really the good point. And, you know, in response to your question, Larry, what does one year mean? Probably nothing. But if it's in the context of 10 out of the last 13 years being in the top 10, it means something.
Right. And the whole trends, the whole idea of the trends, not just this one year.
And it's hard, you know, I think for most of us, if you're in your local observation sometimes, if, you know, you think, well, God, it's been really cold here.
Yeah, there's two parts for it. One is the personal experience, right? It's been cold, so what's been going on? We don't have that history that you need for measurements. And the other thing we have to be careful of is just anecdotal evidence.
That's
At some point you think, like, well, the snow used to be a lot deeper when I was younger. And it's like, well, you were a lot smaller.
Yeah, you were. So, right. You're only three feet above the surface.
So it's that science that's routine measurements that are consistent throughout the year that you really need to have to look at change, no matter what that change is.
That's right. And the other thing I'd say is that it also points out the dichotomy between weather and climate. It's easy to get on the bandwagon. You know, I'm sure there's going to be people in the eastern United States today who are going to say, there'll be two camps. One will say, what about this global warming? We've got 3 feet of snow. The other will say, this snowstorm is a result of global warming. And so there'll be these two, you know, diametrically opposed camps. And neither of them is right on that, because weather systems are occurring in the context of a broad climate system. And you can get wild weather systems even if your climate system is 100% behaved and not trending. But it is.
Right.
Yeah. So we're trying to fish the connections out.
Talking today with Steve Ackerman and John Martin about climate and weather. And let me give the number for you to join in. If you have a question or comment, what questions do you have about the current weather or what might be in store for us for the coming winter? The rest of the winter, I should say. Have you witnessed another interesting weather phenomena lately? I think we've got one or two up on our Facebook page, a photo I'm pretty sure that I want to check out. Love to hear from you, and obviously to see your photos if you have them. Go to our Facebook page for that, at the Larry Mueller Show. We'd certainly love to see them. Local observations. Speaking of that, it seems like we haven't had Very much. I have not done a lot of shoveling.
No.
Yeah, no. And there are a lot of people who are happy about that, I found out over the weekend.
Yeah.
People talking to me saying, well, we haven't had any snow.
Yeah. Right, I haven't shoveled any snow, but I've done my fair share of shoveling other things. Maybe we all have. But yeah, the snow is remarkably low compared to the climatology. It's been a snowless winter in the southern part of the state.
And, you know, it's good now to be saying this because we don't have to shovel our driveways, but you know that snow provides good soil moisture in the future.
It sure does.
And so we're going to find some other way to get precipitation into the soil.
That's right.
Well, and it also limits the amount of freeze that occurs in the ground itself, which when you don't have snow, suddenly you got water pipes going
up, right? Yep.
That
and
is
all kinds
correct.
Of other problems.
Like yep.
And in spring, when you've got snow melt, if you've got, you know, you've got, there's less chance for, I think there's less chance for flooding and so forth if you've got less
frozen ground.
Right. Yeah, that's right.
And then, yeah, lake levels and stream levels too. If we don't get the snowfall, we're not going to get those spring water levels.
Right. Right.
Yeah, so lots to think about. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. What are the conditions that dictate how much or how little snow we get in the course of a year?
Around here, there's a couple of big ones that stand out in my mind. One is just the storm track. Where do storms develop across the continent, and how do they track once they've developed? We've had a fair absence of cyclonic storms coming across the southern Great Lakes all winter long. It's really kind of remarkable because even in other warm winters where maybe we get no snow but a lot of rain, we haven't even had rainstorms. So it hasn't been stormy. So that's one thing that's a factor, and it's been unusually depressed this year. The other is lake effect snow. And sometimes that comes in combination with these storms. Other times it comes in their aftermath. But there hasn't been, in the southern part of the state anyway, Milwaukee, South Bend, Chicago, places like that, there hasn't been big lake effect snows either. And so the combination leaves us really in a deficit.
Yeah, even in northern Wisconsin and Minnesota up there, the snow cover is only 12 inches or so, 12 to 18 inches. It's really, really low.
That is low.
Because they're making it up there in the snow. Yeah. Ski places, so that's good. But yeah, there's just not much up there.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Well, we have some callers online. Let me give you the number again to join in if you'd like to call in with a question. Number to call 1-800-642-1234. Certainly means a lot. I mean, as an agricultural state, I mean, we need snow cover and we need the snow.
Yeah,
right. Yeah,
it's critical.
It's important.
Yeah.
Part of our climate.
It sure is.
Absolutely. We have some predictions. I know you're going to have some predictions for us, but let's go to Eric in Kenosha next. Eric, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I had two questions, and I'll ask them and then listen off the air. My first one was, I'm a scientist, so I know how important the collection of data is. How can your guest give us an idea of how many temperature measurements, at least different places around the world, that they collect data from to get this number of the hottest day of the year so that, you know, people realize that? And the second question was, if they could collect any kind of data that we don't now to get a better picture of the climate, what would they collect? I know we collect surface temperatures in the ocean, and do we collect enough in the atmosphere? So those are my questions.
Hmm.
All right.
Well, those are two good questions.
Yeah, I think I don't know the exact number for the first one, but I know that the Hadley Center and NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and then the Goddard Institute for Space Studies, they're three institutes that do this global average temperature for the surface. And I know it's thousands of observations, and it's not just observations over land. It's also observations over the ocean by ships of opportunity and so on that are combined into this giant data set. So and then they'll also break these things down by month for the year, and also regional, so you can get different segments of that data. But when the statement comes out that the year has been the warmest one ever, it involves thousands, probably many more than 10,000 observations of surface temperatures, both over the land and over the ocean. And then they're processed in a way to make sure that there are no biases in those data. Like if they're in a city versus in a rural area, they try to make corrections for those kinds of things. And their corrections are made in a blind fashion. They're not done in order to point the average in one direction or the other. They're done completely independently of then summing them up to get the average. So it's a lot of data.
Hmm. All right.
So what observation would you take?
Oh, yeah.
That's an interesting one. So what do we really need to have improved observations of in order to monitor change? I might go with precipitation over oceans.
Yeah, and especially maybe the tropical oceans.
Isn't that right?
Could really nail that down would be very valuable.
And good temporal coverage, not just, now we get it 2, maybe 4 times a day from satellites and accurate measurements. But that might be what I would go for.
Yeah, and along with that, I'd love it if we could, we're going to fantasize if we could measure the vertical velocities that are producing the clouds and precipitation.
Right, yeah, to know what the forcing is.
Yeah. That'd be nice.
And actually, good snowfall measurements would be good, too.
Yeah, oh, my God. We could do something about that. That's a disaster that's looming. Exactly right. Oh, boy, that's bad. And a totally unforced error.
Right.
Oh,
yeah.
Man.
Yeah.
Well, Ron in La Crosse has something. Ron, hi. Thanks for calling.
Yes. I'd like to lend some perspective to the long-term, as they say, climate change, global warming. When I was going to school back in the early 1960s, this time of year was usually the coldest time of year, and my brother and I, when we were walking to school, we'd talk about, we'd walk to school about a few blocks in sub-zero weather, and I mean sub-zero Fahrenheit. It got, 16 below and stuff, and then we'd say, we'd converse, and we'd say, looking forward how it's going to get up to zero the next day or next 2 days, and we consider that, well, that's a break in this cold front. So, if these people think that, 0 degrees Fahrenheit is cold, we used to walk to school in much colder weather than that. But I haven't seen that cold a winter in a long time. I mean, it does drop below zero once in a while, but I don't think it's doing it as often.
Yeah, that's right. And when you look at the so here's a case where the anecdotal evidence matches the science data really well. When you look at the temperature measurements that are consistent and at stations that have, 100-year records, so a long time series, two things you find out about winter temperatures is that, one, we're not getting as cold at night as we have been even 50 years ago. And the other is the one that you're pointing out. We're not seeing as many of these really extreme cold days. So that's what's really leading up to the warming temperatures in the wintertime, those two factors.
Yeah, and I mentioned earlier that last winter, despite its regional cold here, was the warmest one a mile above the ground in the last 66 years. However, the coldest 5 in those last 66 years occurred in an 8-year period from the mid-60s to the early 1970s. So it's exactly as Steve says, the anecdotal evidence is right on with the actual data. So there was a period in the 60s and early 70s where it was colder across the hemisphere, and certainly true also here in North America.
Yeah.
Now, there we go. And up on our Facebook page, Chris posted something, the 10 warmest years on record globally. He said, anecdotal, this is fact.
This is right, yeah.
This is fact. We can talk some more about that. And certainly, Ron and or Judy and Soldiers Grove, I hope you'll stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, look at the news, and then we will be right back with our guests, John Martin and Steve Ackerman. Great to have you listening in on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Never a shortage of things to talk about with the weather guys, Steve Ackerman and John Martin. They'll be talking about what we can experience on the horizon weather-wise, answer your questions as well. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for joining us. Here on the IdeasNet, John is professor of atmospheric and oceanic sciences. John, great to have you back.
Great to be here, Larry. Thank you.
And Steve Ackerman directs the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. Thank you for coming.
It's great to be here.
We have Judy in Soldiers Grove with a question, so let's go to her. Thank you for waiting, Judy.
Oh, no problem. Thank you, gentlemen. Here I am in the heart of the Driftless area, and we got a slight dusting of snow this morning. But what my question is for you, gentlemen, is that do you think we'll see significant sea levels rising, particularly around, the United States, Great Britain, Japan, within, say, the next 25 years? Mm-hmm. I'll take the answer off the air.
Yeah. If you're in Miami, should you be...
I would be looking at the maps. I mean, the amount of estimates of the change in sea level rise over the next 25, 50 years ranges from anywhere, I'd say, from about a foot to several feet. I'm not sure I go along with the several feet, but I think on the minimum edge of that is probably what we'll be seeing for sure.
Right, and I think another way to keep this broad issue in the right context is to remind yourself that you don't really need much of a, you know, quiet day, no wind at the beach, sea level rise, to have it become a really significant thing when a storm is on your beach. And that's what we saw in Sandy. That's what we're probably going to see in parts of New England and New York State today. These are, you know, if it's been a 2-inch or 3-inch sea level rise over the last 100 years, that doesn't sound like much until you have low sea level pressure over the ocean that makes the water level rise, and then you have winds driving big waves, and they come inland further than they used to as a consequence right. that they're starting out at a slightly higher position. So the damage that a creeping sea level can do is not necessarily the one we think about whether our beach will get smaller
yeah.
on every day. It'll be when the big storms come.
Yeah,
I mean, from about 50 years ago, the sea level has risen by about 5 inches, 4 or 5 inches, which again doesn't seem like a lot, but that's a lot of water.
It is, and it was enough to get Mayor Bloomberg to take all the electrical switches out of the South Station tunnels down there at the end of Manhattan in October of 2012, and they saved $1 billion by doing that.
Yeah.
Wow.
And that was a forecast triumph.
Smart
as well
planning.
As a, yeah, great planning.
Yeah, great planning. Judy, thanks. That's a great question. Appreciate your call. We had another caller online who we lost, but I think I know his question had to do with a friend who is a climate change denier, and the friend is quoting to him NASA quotes saying that NASA says we are in a multi-year cooling trend, and he wonders, how does he respond to this friend?
Yeah, I don't know anybody at NASA who says we're in a multi-year cooling trend. I think this is probably related to not so much NASA scientists, former scientists who are at a different university now, who were using observations from NASA satellites. And so as John was saying earlier, one way to look at temperature trends is to have thermometers stationed at tens of thousands of stations across the globe. Another way is to use satellite data. To look at those temperature mm-hmm. trends. And one thing that they were looking at was looking at the atmospheric temperatures, and the trends that they were getting were different than other methods of looking at these trends. And so there was a lot of discussion about what the difference is. But that's been resolved in the sense that, and this just again goes to how careful you have to analyze the data. It turns out the altitudes of the satellites was impacting what the retrieval was. And it wasn't until we looked at this decreasing trend or these differences in the trends that people explored it and said, oh, no, we got to account for the altitude of the satellites. And once they accounted for that, then everything lined up again.
Wow. So
yeah, it's not that what NASA is seeing is not inconsistent with what everybody else is seeing.
Yeah.
Camille in Frankfort, Michigan has something for us. Camille, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. I have understood that even though the ocean levels will go down, the Great Lakes levels will go down, the lake levels will go down. Is that true, and can you explain why?
Yeah, that's a really good thing, and I'll tell you, I wish there was more research being done on this. The reason why that the lake levels are going to be going down in the Great Lakes regions, or why people think they're going to be going down, is two reasons. One is that in the wintertime, there's less ice on the lakes. And so that less ice is causing more evaporation of the water in the lakes, and that drives the level of the lakes down. And the other part of that, and I think this is the one that it's not always clear what's going to be happening, is precipitation in the watershed. That feeds the obviously the water source for the Great Lakes. And there's indications that it's not clear to me, let me put it that way, in terms mm-hmm. of what's going to happen to precipitation in the Great Lakes regions. I've seen studies that look at, and it says that in the northern regions of Wisconsin, it looks like it may be decreasing, but heavy precipitation may be going up. This is one of the reasons why I said if we had other observations, I would want better precipitation ones.
Yeah, and that's a really good point. I think the notion that we have a really clear view of how broad global scale climate change, which is occurring, is going to impact the parade and the distribution of weather systems in all seasons of the year and therefore affect our local weather is a tenuous connection now. We're trying to build that. Of course, it's an important question, but we don't really have confidence in our answers on that yet. And yet sometimes statements will be made as if there were confident answers already, you know, established about that. About
and there was a good study by some folks in Michigan who looked at 2014, because 2014 was a real cold winter. We had a lot of ice on the Great Lakes. And not only that, though, we also, so that would reduce evaporation, but we also had a lot of precipitation in the basin of the Great Lakes. And as a result, you know, for years we've been talking about how the Great Lake levels have been down.
Yeah.
Well, they rapidly caught up.
Yeah.
And now they're above average. And they did that all in like a year and a half.
Those two dials are the biggest ones on the board, you know, the ice cover in the winter and how much precipitation
does. Yeah. And it worked well for us in 2014.
Sure did.
And how that's going to work in the future, I think, is a really open question.
That's right.
Really interesting. Phil sent us a photo on our Facebook page. By the way, there's a couple of cool photos on our Facebook page. So as you're listening in or at some point, go to our Facebook page. It's titled The Larry Mueller Show. That's the Facebook page. And Phil's got a photo here. He says, I don't ski, but I believe you guys call this snow sparkle, correct?
I call that snow sparkle. Yeah, it's a picture of snow on the ground, and there's sparkles scattered all over. It's kind of like
white
Tinkerbell dust
scattered
all over. And what it is that they're ice crystals, and they're probably flat structured ice crystals that are just laying on the surface. And as the sun, it's got to be a clear day, cloud-free day, and as the sun comes down and hits those ice crystals, they act like mirrors. And so what you're seeing is individual ice crystals that the sunlight is reflecting off of. It's really fascinating. I have a hobby of looking for this, because what's also really interesting, if you look carefully, and you don't see it in this photo, is that as you walk by, of course, it's just going to sparkle because you're going to see different ice crystals.
Right.
And the other thing is, every now and then you'll also see color, because as the light reflects off this surface, the top surface, then you'll just get the white light. But sometimes the light will reflect off the bottom surface of that ice crystal, in which case the colors will begin to separate just like they do in a rainbow.
They get refracted in the ice.
They get refracted. And so you'll see
they're
red tinklings and things.
Does it happen more when it's dry? It seems like when the snow is really dry, Judith at least says she sees it more.
I think you see it more when it's dry for a couple of reasons. One is that if you can get an ice crystal on there, then it may also then start to grow as it's sitting there.
Okay.
I think the crystals stay more separate when the snow is fairly dry and falls at a cold temperature. And I think in the picture, too, you see these lines across the snow.
Yeah,
about
those lines.
Little topography. That's just light winds, probably, sometimes heavier than light winds, blowing across, almost the way you see those little ripples in the sand at the beach where the water is doing that. It's kind of moving little particles of the sand around. These snowflakes, it's consistent with the idea they sparkle. They're easy to make separate, so they get blown around easier by the wind, even if it's light.
Yeah, if it's warmer, then they'll stick together when they collide.
Right? Yeah, and you lose a lot of things that way.
And those lines are kind of like waves. They look a little bit waves.
Just like the ripples you see in the sand at the beach, exactly the same thing.
And I did want to mention somewhere here, where is it? Blast it. I guess I can't, for some reason, I can't get it, but there was another really cool, really nice photo of along a beach, which made me really. It was the summertime.
We saw that at the break. We don't want to talk about that, Larry, on a snowy day.
It's really beautiful.
Nice sunset,
it was warm.
It looks
liquidy
so
water.
Nice. I'm sure it's still there, but I just am not finding it right now.
That was a nice photo.
It was a really nice photo. Let's see. Another question here. You were talking about growing. What does it mean when you say it grows?
Oh, the ice crystals.
Oh, yeah. Ice crystals will grow. And actually, I'm glad that came up because I probably said it wrong. I think John's explanation of the ice crystals not sticking together and therefore being further apart. Actually, I think in a moister environment is where you would see the ice crystals grow.
Yeah, that's right.
So ice crystals will grow as the water vapor in the atmosphere deposits onto them. It's called deposition.
Hmm.
And in drier environments, you're not going to have that as much. So I said that wrong. I'm glad somebody pointed that out. Gosh, I'm wrong again.
Well, I don't worry about that
anymore. And somebody caught it.
Well, Roxanne emailed and said, my husband has a question about the increased use of solar and wind energy sources. He believes that using solar panels and wind turbines to capture that energy has a negative impact on the Earth. Is that true? Do solar panels and wind turbines impact the Earth in a negative way?
Yeah, that's a good question. And I think the answer is no, particularly globally. Regionally, I know there's been studies looking at wind turbines, and what they tend to do is dry out the soil around them, as you would expect, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's just like an air fan going on, and that tends to cause evaporation. Soil panels, you know, I can imagine, it, depending on the material that it's made out of, because usually you're trying to absorb all the solar energy. And so they're black. But a lot of times they're not going to get hot, as you might think, because what they're trying to do is grab that heat and automatically convert it into energy in some way. So it's not going to be like an urban heat island effect, which we see you know, in cities and things like that.
We had a Facebook question from Wendy, who says her father was an environmental scientist who in the 1970s talked to Wendy about the impact of melting freshwater from the poles on climate because of disruption of ocean patterns. Mm. What are your thoughts on that? That was
that
in the 70s.
That's a really interesting problem. It's one of some people talk about, what do they call it, sudden onset climate change or something. It's a better word for that. I just can't seem to recall it at the time. But one of the things that happens in the western part of the Atlantic Basin is the Gulf Stream. It's one of the warm currents. There's one in the Pacific, too, called the Curacao. The Gulf Stream is a circulation of warm tropical water at the surface all the way to the high latitudes. It's why England and parts of northern Europe are warmer than they ought to be for their latitudes. That depends upon cold water at high latitudes sinking to the bottom of the ocean and driving part of that circulation. If the ice melts at the high latitudes, then what comes out on the top surface of the water is fresh water, which is very light. It's less dense than the surface water that exists there in the absence of that. And so it inhibits that downward sinking of the cold water, the cold salty water, and that can shut down that circulation. That's the theoretical idea, and it makes good physical sense. If you stop having that water sink at high latitudes and drive part of the circulation, that sinking is inhibited by the melting of sea ice, you have some problems. Yeah. And you have to have, it's really cool, you have to have strong storms going up across the Atlantic coast of North America, the United States and Canada, to help ventilate that Labrador Sea. With strong winds, it helps to cool that top surface water to the point where it sinks. So you need all of these things are interconnected.
Wow!
And if you start throwing monkey wrenches into that natural system, you're going to have problems. Yeah. Things are not going to behave the way they do now.
Tammy in Madison. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi.
And what can we do? Yeah, go ahead, please.
I was the person who sent in the photo of the fog bow on your Facebook page. And I was wondering if you could describe what causes a fog bow.
So a fog bow...
It's like a rainbow.
It's like a rainbow, but it's white.
Only made out of fog.
Yep.
And it was beautiful. It was on Dauphin Island in Alabama. We were there a couple of weeks ago. And it was just spectacular to see. The picture doesn't do it justice. Oh,
cool. Yeah, it's a gorgeous picture. And
really
I'm very jealous because I have never seen one.
Me either.
But what it is, it's the same process as a rainbow. And the difference is that they're in a rainbow, it's raindrops that are doing the interaction with the light. And in a fog bow, it's fog droplets. And the fog droplets are a lot smaller. And so as the sunlight penetrates the droplets and reflects off the back of the drops, because they're smaller, there isn't enough distance, if you will, to separate the colors out from refraction. Mm-hmm. And so we can't distinguish the difference in the colors. And it just looks like a white bow.
Wow, that is cool.
Yeah, it's really nice.
It's really cool. And it's a nice photo, Tammy.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, it was there for quite a while too. It didn't just appear and go away. It was at least 15 minutes, 20 minutes that it was up there. And as you moved, it moved just like a rainbow does. And we were trying to find the other, you know, the other end when we were walking back to the house from the beach, and it was fun.
And so did you notice, I mean, the shape of the shape of the rainbow and how high it gets, or the fog bow, is a function of where you are and where the sun is in the sky. So I'm wondering, a 15-minute time period, if you could actually see it changing its altitude as the sun got higher in the sky.
Oh, cool, yeah.
You know, would it look flatter with time?
Yeah, it did look flatter.
Yeah.
Oh.
That's pretty cool.
Longer and flatter.
Yeah.
Well, anyway, I really appreciate
it. So
yeah, thanks so much for calling. And it's great to have this posted. Judith got it up on our Facebook page, and it is very.
Yeah, it looks like a very light fog, too. It's not a real thick one. Well,
yeah.
It can't be too thick, otherwise you wouldn't see, right?
Yeah,
right. That's right. That's what makes them so rare, I bet.
Right, yeah.
Everything's got to be perfect to see it.
Just right, yeah.
I think there's maybe another photo. Well, let's see. I'll get to that. Let's go to Jim next in Wanakee. Jim, hi. Thanks for calling.
Oh, hi. Thanks for the program. I have a quick question about the role of methane, the release of methane. And I had heard a report some time ago from a scientific report that with the polar ice melting, that there's methane, coming from the organic stuff as it melts underneath the ice, and that is actually 87 times more potent than carbon dioxide in terms of climate warming. I'm just wondering if you could explain a little bit about how this is the methane release is facilitating the climate warming at an alarming rate.
Hmm. Yeah. The methane is a greenhouse gas, just like carbon dioxide is. And by greenhouse gas, what we mean by that is that when the solar energy comes to the atmosphere, those gases don't absorb very much solar energy. But the energy heats the surface, and then the surface emits longer wavelength radiation that the gas will absorb, like carbon dioxide. And the thing about methane is that it absorbs in a region where the atmosphere is currently pretty transparent. So typically at wavelengths of about, we'll call them 10 microns or so, energy that the surface emits, and there's a lot of energy at that wavelength that the surface emits at, escapes out to space. And as we increase methane, that's the window that it'll absorb in. And so that's why it's often referred to as being a much more potent gas than carbon dioxide, for example.
Yeah, and as you pointed out, Jim, the methane is trapped in the permafrost. It's called, I think it's clathrates or something like that is the name for it. Yeah. And it's decaying organic matter that's frozen at high latitudes in the permafrost. And when the permafrost begins to melt, then that stuff gets released as gaseous methane into the atmosphere. It's just one of several really intriguing and dangerous feedbacks about warming that occur at the high latitudes. The other one that's kind of a standout we talked about, well, there's two more. One of them is the ice melting. The other is a little bit of a decrease in the snow cover, which reduces how much incoming solar radiation is reflected during the warm part of the season, and that contributes to more warming that can even have a long-standing effect into the next cold season. So it's really a very sensitive place, the high latitudes of the Northern Hemisphere in particular.
There we go. Thank you very much for calling, Jim. I want to go back to our Facebook page because Rita posted a photo, January 6th sunrise, accompanied by sun glories, or pillars of fire, as I heard them called.
Wow, yeah.
That's awesome,
isn't it?
So, a lot of times when I think about pillars of fire or sun dogs, although this doesn't look like a sun dog either.
No, that's like a sun dog.
It's up in the sky, but this is in, there's a bunch of trees without their leaves in which this is occurring in. So
That's
an odd one. I don't know if the sun is right behind it that's generating the colors, and so would it be like
blowing snow. I've seen a sun pillar before, and it's in an environment where there's a little bit of blowing snow, suspended snow. It may even be falling sometimes, but not in the case I saw. And it wasn't. I mean, I'm sure that if Rita were to testify, she'd say it was even more dramatic in real life.
Right, yeah.
But this picture is dramatic. The ones I've seen are less dramatic than this in real life.
Yeah. It's like this rainbow vertical line.
Yeah,
awesome. It's really, really, really cool. Pam, thanks again. Pam in Madison, you have a quick comment.
I do. I wish we could change the term from global warming with an N to global warning with an N so that we don't have to defend all this weather stuff. We can say it's a warning. All these extremes are a warning.
A warning that things are changing.
Exactly.
Yeah. I think we should instead, I would suggest that we call it what it really is, because the planet is warming. And what we're trying to do is endeavor to figure out what are the ramifications for that. So I think I would rather that we stick with the current word and just fight the battles. But that doesn't mean we're going to win them against the skeptics. But I think if we what you're saying has merit, of course, but it still avoids the fundamental fact that the planet's warming.
And your opinion of the new chair over the EPA?
Oh, boy.
Okay.
I don't like the fact that people are willfully ignorant about something that can be tested with observations and analysis, and they instead decide to impose an assertion as if it were fact. And I think that the chairman is definitely guilty of that. He has been for a long time, and he should be called out on it. He's a responsible, an irresponsible public official who could instead become a responsible public official. That's what I feel.
And on that note, I wish I knew what your opinion was on that. John Martin.
Maybe I shouldn't
water it down. We believe in science. We believe in science.
That was the whole show today, science up and down. And today, the last 45 minutes with our two guests, Steve Ackerman and John Martin, our weather guys. They'll be back the last Monday of next month, and we'll do it all over again. Tomorrow, we'll talk about fitness and how to reach your fitness goals for this coming year. Thanks for listening. Stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.